Welcome back to Firewall. My guest today is someone that I've known for a while now and someone that I'm very, very fond of, Joel Klein. So Joel and I got to know each other when he was the chancellor of New York City schools, and we were both working in and around Mike Bloomberg, and have become really good friends and stayed so ever since. And what's interesting about Joel is his career is just so wide-ranging. He's done big things in so many different fields that either it is he's kind of the wandering Jew, or he's this guy who's figured it all out. But either way, should be a pretty fascinating interview. So, Joel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bradley. Thrilled to be here.
And so, you know, just because not all of our listeners may know your background, you've done so many things from the taking on Microsoft at the Justice Department to running New York City schools to founding startups and everything else. Just give us the quick story from kind of how you got from growing up in Queens and public housing to all of a sudden becoming, you know, one of the most prominent people in the country.
So mostly it's because I'm a man who evidently can't hold a job because I keep moving from one to the other. But I think a little bit it's why I'm so passionate about education. Teachers at Bryan High Schools really showed me a way forward. They architected something that I thought was unimaginable, got me into Columbia. From there I got into Harvard Law School. And really became sort of an appellate lawyer. That's what my thing was. I clerked for Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court, who had a huge impact on me, and had a law practice. I did some constitutional litigation, but it was mainly an appellate practice. I argued about a dozen cases in the Supreme Court, and I had come to know Bill Clinton in a variety of ways. When he got elected president, the job I wanted, because I thought it was kind of where I fit best, was Solicitor General.
Right.
And then, of course, and I knew Zoe Baird well, and of course, I'm not saying I would have gotten it, but I was close to Zoe. It looked like things were going to go well. Then that didn't work out.
She was the, for people who don't remember, she was Clinton's, I guess, first nominee for Attorney General.
Attorney General.
Right, and then she didn't pay taxes on her nanny. Was that?
That's the, about
took
it.
Took her out, yeah.
So she came down, so I went back to practicing law, arguing cases. Next thing that happened was Byron White stepped off the Supreme Court. He retired. And so Clinton asked me, could I help him vet a few people? And I was in the middle of their selection, helped them with Justice Ginsburg. And then she asked me to handle a confirmation. Now, there was when my whole life pivoted, because I'm in the middle of this thing when Vince Foster kills himself. He was the deputy White House counsel at the time. So all of a sudden, I'm kind of hanging around, and people say to me, why don't you become deputy White House counsel?
Was Mick for the counsel at the time?
No, at the time, Bernie Nussbaum was.
Okay.
So they made me deputy White House counsel, which was weird for a totally non-political guy. And so eventually I worked my way back to the Justice Department, but not to the Solicitor Generalship, to the Assistant Attorney General for antitrust. And in the middle of that, of course, that was the era of Microsoft.
Was the Microsoft case already coming together when you got there, or did you get there and say, hey, we should look at these guys?
No, I got there and put the case together. They had been looked at for a couple of mergers, but this was the big case.
And what made you think, okay, you know, this is something that is becoming so big and so powerful that it's actually becoming a threat that we have to look at? What about it made you think that?
Well, a lot of people were coming to me, but what it was really fundamentally, when I look what happened with the browser and dug into it, meaning Microsoft controlled the operating system, they could load anything they want into that operating system, they had ubiquitous distribution through the operating system, and nothing else could do that. In other words, everybody understand network effects. The browser was the only other thing than an operating system, which at that point, this was 1998, 99. At that point, it was the only other thing that would have ubiquitous distribution. And so all of a sudden, I saw what would be coming, whether it was voice, whether it was search, that Microsoft could bundle it in, basically optimize their operating system. So that's what caused the concern. Brought in a lot of good people, including hiring David Boyce from outside the Justice Department to try the case. And so that became, for me, and that whole era became an enormously exciting time. Not just, I mean, technology was transforming media. I mean, a lot of stuff that you've become expert in. All of that was going on. So I got through that and decided I was all of 54, was getting remarried to Nicole Seligman, my current bride, and basically decided I'm going to move to New York. And I thought, I had kind of done the law. I didn't want to go back and defend mergers that I would have blocked when I was the Assistant Attorney General. Bob Rubin told me it'd take 6 months, which is then former Treasury Secretary, take 6 months, talk to everybody, think about what you want to do. And a guy had come to meet, Thomas Middlehoff, who was then CEO of Bertelsmann, wanted to strengthen his U.S. operations, brought me in to do that. In the middle of that, out of nowhere, your friend Mike Bloomberg calls me and said, we'd like to be school chancellor. I said, Mike, you got the wrong Joel Klein. So I was like, out of nowhere.
Did you know him at all?
I did know him. I didn't know him well, but we had a mutual friend who I think put the idea in his head, Margaret Carlson. Yep. Margaret was a very close friend of mine. She knew Mike well. So I had met Mike a handful of times. He had met, when I came to New York, he talked to me about running for mayor. I urged him to do it. So then I do this school thing, and then, of course, I got involved in education technology, and then after
Let's learn on the schools thing. So the school thing was taking the New York City school system, which was run by this Board of Education, which was totally unaccountable to anyone, a total mess, and turning it into an accountable, well-functioning school system, which is the biggest in the United States by a lot, right?
Correct.
What, 1.1 million kids in the
1.1
New York City?
1.1 million
right,
kids.
Bigger than most big cities.
Exactly.
And you had no idea how to do this. So how does that happen? How do you go from knowing nothing about education to not only running the school system, but you're running it, basically remaking it from scratch? And does that make it harder or easier?
A little of both. You have your blind spots, but you're also less afraid and less mired in the pre-existing culture. And so that's what I think Mike was looking for. And in that respect, I thought the great challenges here were going to be leadership management challenges. I didn't think, and in this respect, I may have been wrong, I didn't think getting the perfect curriculum was going to solve the problem. What I did think is a system that has zero accountability, that basically gives very few choices to the poor and lots of choices to the affluent, and a system in which the results for the last decade before I got there, the graduation rate and the graduation standards are not high. The graduation rate was stuck at below 50%. It hadn't moved. All of which led me to think that the challenges would come about not from some, would be met not by some great educator, but certainly with Mike's backing, a willingness to buck a system. And I think one of the things that Mike has said to me subsequently, he knew I wasn't looking for a career appointment here, that I would do the job, that I wasn't going to move on from New York to some other school system. And so he thought that I would at least be willing to take on the deeply entrenched interests, the bureaucrats, the unions, the politicians, all of whom did pretty well on the system. The kids, not so much.
Right.
And that's the reprioritization we did.
And so from there, did you think about staying in education, or you decided you wanted to try something totally different?
Well, I kind of stayed in education, right. A little mixer too. I wanted to do ed tech, which is something that I've always thought could help support teachers, deliver better lessons and so forth. And News Corp at the time and Rupert Murdoch was interested in that. He also was looking for an EVP to work with him on some of the issues they were dealing with. And so those kind of came together, and I did that.
Right, and then you got thrown into the middle of helping with the whole hacking scandal.
The phone hacking scandal.
Which is funny, now it feels kind of like a distant memory, but it was a pretty big deal at the time.
At the time, it was pretty intense stuff.
And then you go from there into healthcare and Oscar, right? Into like a not only a startup within a giant company like News Corp, but like a real true startup. So education, healthcare, technology, media, business, law, government, right?
And teaching at Georgetown.
And teaching at Georgetown. So that's, you know, pretty wide-ranging. Looking back on it, and obviously you're still at Oscar and doing stuff, are you happy that you worked in so many different fields and so many different things because it gave you this wide range of interesting experiences, or do you wish you had stuck with one or two and just kept rising and rising and rising within that?
I go back to the scene at the White House. I guess if I had stuck with one or two, it would have been to be Solicitor General, and if lightning struck, to get on the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court. That was the career path I was on. I have no regrets about the one I actually ended on. I mean, being school chancellor
more
in New
interesting,
York,
yeah.
Well, it's just an amazing richness of opportunity, experience, and growth. I gave a graduation speech once at Georgetown Law School on sort of comparing the arc of my career to the arc of Lewis Powell, the justice I worked for, who really started at Hunt Williams, basically spent his whole career there, was ready to retire when Nixon begged him to go on the Supreme Court. Powell didn't even want to do it. And I said, you know, it's a kind of different strokes for different folks, but for me personally, right now, if I were practicing law at a big law firm, I would be an unhappy camper. Now, I know people who do it and love it. David Boies does it. He's excited about it. I would be an unhappy camper. Whereas doing the schools dipping a toe in the business world where I have, doing the startup stuff, loving what I'm doing at Oscar right now. So in some respects, I think it's a question more about who you are than whether there's a right career path. But what I always tell people of any age is stay open to the possibilities. Because had I not, I wouldn't have become Deputy White House Counsel. I mean, I was at that point, I had a great legal practice. I was arguing a couple of Supreme Court cases a year. I was making a nice amount of money, and it felt pretty good. And so when somebody said be Deputy White House Counsel, I said, that's like for political people. I'm like the non-political
right.
guy,
I'm
right?
I'm a substance guy.
No, yeah. And I don't put it quite so pejoratively, but I know, but I'm like,
As a political guy, I won't take offense.
Right, yeah. No. Well, you're a substantive guy in a political way. But that was the thing that bent the arc and led me to think, there's a lot of life out there. You know, Moon River, there's such a lot of world to see.
So Bill Clinton, Mike Bloomberg, Rupert Murdoch, right? Three pretty iconic bosses, right? How do you compare and contrast each of them, both in your personal experience with them, because you know each of them exceptionally well as human beings, and then they're each your boss?
It's a really great question, and I'm glad you're making me think about it, because I do think I've been privileged to work for three extraordinary people, and three you just mentioned. At a personal level, I had a good relationship with each one of them, but the differences were profound. I mean, Bill Clinton was, to me, a man of intuition, of human comprehension and understanding. He had a great mind, but he saw life through the lens of the poet, but brought the discipline of a lawyer to help transform it. And in that sense, there's nobody I've ever worked for that I ever thought had quite the breadth of skill set that he had and the understanding of people. When Bill Clinton said he felt your pain, he felt your pain. And that's a very rare mix of things. I once did a very sophisticated legal memo for him, and he said, you know, it's a time in my life I could have done something like that. And I kept thinking, I probably could have done it better in his life. And Larry Summers, for the best, he said, very few people you sit with where you have a field of expertise and they're the generalist and they know more than you about it. Mike was, to me, the consummate manager. He was the man that I loved working for because he had your back, he gave you authority, and he basically held you accountable. And he knew how to manage people, he knew how to get you. I mean, I always thought, I think accountability is very good, but I had a couple of accountable meetings with Mike, which made me think accountability could be overrated.
Yeah, I'm familiar with those meetings. You know? Yeah.
But my favorite one, he used to call me when I screwed something up, you know, he'd read about it in the paper. And he used to call me like at 6 in the morning to yell at me. So this one morning he calls, it's like 5:30. He said, oh, I must have done really something bad. So I said, what do I do now, Mike? He said, no, it's not what you do, Joel. He said, I'm just so angry. Randy Weingarten, the head of the teachers union, is in the paper calling for you to be fired. He said, now I can't even fire you if I want to. That is the essential Michael Bloomberg. And it's the thing I love about him. Rupert, the thing that sticks out in one's mind, I've never seen a man so unafraid of what's out there. I mean, the guy is now in his late 80s, and he is willing to take risks. He's never looking back, take a lot of risks. Some turn out well, some don't. For him, a lot more turned out well than didn't. But there is a fearlessness and a voraciousness about life. The other thing that I think would surprise people about Rupert, he's got one of the most curious minds I've ever met. I mean, many nights when he couldn't sleep, he'd call at 4:35 in the morning, not to talk necessarily about business, but to talk about this aspect of the world or that aspect, or how do you think about this? And so very different people, showing that there's no sort of preset formula for ultimate sort of successful leadership.
What would you say, I mean, there's a lot of ideological purity right now in the world, the resistance and all of that, and they would say, Joel, you must not believe in anything. You worked for a traditional Democrat like Bill Clinton. You worked for an independent business guy like Mike Bloomberg. You worked for the creator of Fox News and Rupert Murdoch. Do you have no values, no principles, right? And it feels like we now live in a world where someone could attack you for effectively being all over the spectrum. What's your answer to that?
My answer is I did the things where I thought I could have impact and effect. People gave me the opportunities. I mean, Rupert gave me a huge opportunity to try and create a digital curriculum that I thought would have real impact in public education. Mike gave me an opportunity to run the school system. Bill Clinton gave me an opportunity to serve in the antitrust division, where I thought we could do important things for the economy. I never felt in any of these things that I was being called upon to sacrifice my own principles. My principles are pretty well known. I mean, I'm a, if you will, Clinton Democrat. But if I could have impact in other arenas with people who I thought were going to trust me to give me the authority I needed and knew I wasn't going to compromise my principles. When I had my first interview with the New York Times, you'll get a kick out of this. Because in the old days, before Mike was chancellor, before Mike was mayor, the chancellor was somewhat independent. He reported to a school board, didn't right. report to the mayor. So the Times said to me, said, how are we going to know when you and Bloomberg are having a fight? And I said, you're not going to know that. And they were so disappointed because it's great grist for the news mill. And they said, well, you mean if you disagree with the mayor, you're not going to let us know? You're not going to leak that? I said, no. I said, how will we ever know? I said, if it gets serious enough that I resign, then you'll know about it. Other than that, you won't. And I never even came close in any of the things. I mean, when I handled phone hacking, I was very clear about the scope of my authority. I reported directly to the board, not to the executives. And so I've been pretty clear about that, and my values, I'm pretty comfortable with.
Do you think people worry too much about being criticized and kind of not being ideologically pure, you know, people chasing commencement speakers off of campuses and things like
that? I think
like
it's
that.
Nuts.
Yeah.
I think the inability to listen to people like Condi Rice is crazy to
right.
me.
I mean, you look at the experiences you've had and the impact you've been able to have on the world by being open to working for people with different ideologies, different styles, different approaches. And it feels like, I mean, to me, so many people now shut themselves off because they're so afraid of being labeled as something that they don't want to associate with themselves, that they really miss out on a lot of opportunity. And you've, to your credit, never done that.
They miss out on opportunity. They miss out on learning. I mean, only people who are afraid won't listen to other people. And that doesn't mean you have to agree, and it doesn't mean you don't push back very hard. But what's happening on our campuses now, it's not something I think we should be particularly proud of.
No. Your phone, it's your way online. Your camera, your transportation hub, your entertainment system, it's your very lifeblood. But what if you find yourself alone in a dark alley in the middle of the night? Sure, you can call 911, you can text someone for help. But will help really arrive in time? Is your phone today really enough to protect you? It is now with Phaser. All the capabilities of an iPhone, all the electric shock of a taser. Just hold the phone on its side, point, press the strike button on your screen, and you've got 50,000 volts right at your fingertips. And don't take our word for it, ask our customers.
I used to carry around mace, a switchblade, and a billy club. Now I can just carry my phone and it's all I need, anytime, anywhere. Thanks, Phaser.
Phaser, protect your phone, protect yourself. Available at Best Buy today. So speaking of education, K-12 is still a world that I assume you pay a lot of attention to and care a lot about. Let's start with, I'm going to give you a magic wand, then I'm going to take it away. But in giving you the magic wand of saying, okay, Joel, you're now chancellor of all of American schools, and you don't have to worry about budgets, teachers' unions, legislatures, catering special interests, or anything else, give me the five things that would most have the greatest impact on America's K-12 school system today.
So right now, I think really building out the effective charter schools, I would put number one. I mean, the KIPPs and the uncommons and the successes. Number two, I would say, is change the way we recruit, hire, pay, reward teachers, and incentivize teachers to take on the toughest challenges in the school system. Number three, I would say, is let's get back to curriculum that's rich, based on knowledge, not based so much on sort of value-based rather than knowledge-based. Kids need, particularly in this world, one of the things that shocked me, Bradley, is when I was school chancellor, is how little kids knew about history, how little science they knew. So those three things. The fourth thing would be the infusion of technology to help support teachers. I don't think you can have technology that replaces teachers. I don't think that the online courses are a substitute for what goes on in schools. And then the fifth thing, which I did start and wish I had done more when I was chancellor, is meaningful career education. The thing we did with P-TECH is a really important thing, and it's been replicated time and time again. So those, if I had the magic wand, that's I didn't have to negotiate with anybody, zip.
So now let's go into the real world. And you've got lots and lots
this
of people.
This is no fun.
That people who listen to this podcast are interested in politics. We're in the real world now of things that you fought through every single day for 8 years. Teachers unions, legislators, budgets, lots of competing adults who have their own interests in the system. And the point that I felt like you always made was you know, everyone was fighting for their interests, all the adults, and no one was looking out for the kids. And right. I think that's how you saw your role and how Mike saw his role. So given the reality of where we are today, of the five things you just listed, which ones are doable? Where should people should be focusing?
I think the one that's most critical right now is continuous expansion of the effective charter school. Not every charter school is effective. What I mean by that is when we started in New York City, there were a few thousand kids. Now, because of the work Mike did, there were over 100,000 kids. It's more than 10%. That'll grow just in its natural course, 150,000, 200,000. Not everybody needs to be in a charter school, but there are 50,000 poor kids, mostly children of color in New York, who right now are on the waiting list for the success academies, et cetera. Expand that. Eli Broad's trying to do that in L.A. People, Reed Hastings is pushing that. I think a lot of people get that because it gives people a scalable opportunity to have some choice. If the neighborhood school is great in Harlem or in Bed-Stuy, go for it.
But what is an effective charter school, a KIPP, a success doing that makes it imperative to keep growing its network that's so much better than a lot of the other options?
So they're doing probably two or three things that are critical. They're recruiting great leaders who in turn recruit great teachers and support them. They actually believe that observing people, knowing how to move people forward, giving them feedback, makes them better at what they do, which is a classic management principle that gets ignored in the public schools. What they do is they work longer and harder, which kids who are struggling need more of. What they do is they don't sit back with low expectations. And a number of people in our chancellor said, you know, kids who grow up in poverty and challenged families are not going to do well in school because they come from broken homes. But that's just demonstrably not true. It doesn't mean that they don't have challenges you have to address. But if you assume away the problem, nobody who ever assumed away a problem solved it. And so that's a big part of what they're doing. And when you see the results, people like Eva Moskowitz are getting in New York, those are really different, order of magnitude, different results. So this is doable. And again, it doesn't deny that a kid who grows up in a really difficult environment creates educational challenges that you have to meet. But what it says to me is there's a hell of a lot more we could be doing than we are doing.
Soft bigotry of low expectations.
It's a great quote. I wish I had had it.
How involved are you still in education reform?
Still involved. I'm on the board of Teach for America. I'm on a couple of other Student First New York, which is a local organization that's active in school reform. So I stay in. You know, I talk to and mentor and advise people who are in the game.
It felt like, and this may just be because I was more involved in it then than I am now, but there was this moment 5, 6, 7 years ago where, you know, Michelle Rhee kind of had her success as chancellor in D.C., Jeffrey Canada, Waiting for Superman comes out, and there's this movement around charter schools and around education reform and all of this support coalescing from all these different sectors of society. Is that still the case? Does it still have as much momentum and energy behind it as it did 5, 6 years ago, or has it dissipated? And if it has dissipated, why?
I think it has dissipated some, and I think it's dissipated in part because the unions and the others who are in the game are there 24/7. And the reformers, I think, inevitably, they don't have the dues, they don't have the constituencies, they have to face the challenges of creating a world that people haven't yet seen and trying to convince people it's better than one they're giving up. So I think ultimately, in that respect, Machiavelli was right that basically trying to change a well-defended status quo is hard. And so you saw really good people get chewed up and burned up, and it's Kevin Huffman, Cammie Anderson. So eventually I think the message is people say this is probably more than they want to bite off. However, the one thing I said, the two things that I remain optimistic on, I think you can't put the charter genie back in the bottle. The people in the communities that need help the most, they're going to insist on it. I mean, if you tried to shut down charter schools in New York, it wouldn't happen. Could not happen. And I think that's going to be true throughout the country. And second of all, I think we're beginning through models like the PTEC model, where you really get industry deeply involved in the schools, to think intelligently about vocational training in the schools. So those two avenues seem optimistic. The things like we did with ADEF report cards, accountability, holding teachers to account for student outcomes, I think those things have lost a lot of steam.
Yeah, I mean, you had a string of mayors, a Bloomberg, a Booker, a Fenty, a Nutter, who seemed really committed to charters, to ed reform, and none of those people are in office anymore, at least as mayor. Do we have leaders, whether it's the Jeff Canadas and Michelle Reeves on the ed reform side, or political leaders like mayors or chancellors like you today who can still carry this mantle?
Yeah, no, take a look at John White in Louisiana. You got some of the work that's being done in Denver right now. Deborah Gist down in Tulsa. I do think there are people. I mean, I think the school board that just got elected in Los Angeles is going to bring about some meaningful reform. Denver's had a tough school board for a number of years. But if you ask me, the velocity, I think, starting in New York, going through D.C., being picked up in other places, Pete Gorman was down in Charlotte, North Carolina. Arne Duncan was in Chicago. There was a sense, I'll never forget, we had about 16 to 18 soups do a piece in around 2010, 2011 in the Washington Post that articulated a set of principles that were really quite powerful, even radical, if you will. I don't think you'd see that today.
Right. I mean, ironically, even though Obama was a Democrat, he and Arne did a lot through Race to the Top, and it hasn't really been replicated yet so far in Trump. Now, we're only still, amazingly, only 6 months in. It feels like it's been a lifetime. But it does feel like there's a void there. So ed tech, is that a good business to be in? A lot of people listen to this podcast are either in venture capital or they work in a startup or they're thinking of being in a startup. You've now been through ed tech, in and out.
It's a tough business. Yeah. And it's a tough business for a couple of reasons. One, you've got to sell through this request for proposal process to thousands and thousands of different school districts that are used to doing things in a certain way. So that makes it very challenging. Second reason it's challenging is, in order for EdTech to be impactful, you got to change the way teachers do the work they're doing. And while I would say there's reason for some optimism, that's a pretty heavy lift. And so one of the things I learned is we try to bite off more than I think we should have at the outset. We should have done it in smaller units, smaller pieces. But if you ask me, is EdTech a place where all I cared about are returns for venture capitalists, I wouldn't put it at the top of the list.
Yeah, so if a VC says to you, Joel, I'm thinking about investing in ed tech company X or Y or Z, what should I be looking for? What red flags should I look out for? What's the answer?
I think the red flags go back to the way the sales process is. Yeah. You're not selling, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's the big companies, right, they got so long and so many sales connections on the ground in the school system. And you don't have, if you're in a startup, you can't sell this stuff on the internet. Now, there may be things you can do outside the conventional system that you can sell through the internet, you can sell through direct sales. That's one thing to look at. Second thing to look at, is it something that teachers will quickly think makes their job, at least if not better, easier? Because if teachers don't become the people that push what you're doing, it won't happen. They are the people that control the operations.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably right. So did Microsoft and Google make money in education?
I think Google did, yeah. I don't know. Microsoft probably made some money in education, sure.
But you have to basically be able to throw a huge amount of money at it.
But they have huge scale, right. And Google made a lot of money off of the tablets. I mean,
right. So in education, it's hard for a startup to kind of enter because the scale required is so big and the system is so bureaucratic. In healthcare, you're working at a startup that I think so far has pretty successfully navigated another big and bureaucratic world, which is health insurance. So, healthcare in America right now, fundamentally okay or fundamentally broken?
Fundamentally not okay.
Why?
Different problem from education, Bradley, but the reason it's not okay is we're spending almost twice what any other industrial country is spending. I mean, think about that. I mean, and we're not getting results that are better. Arguably, we're getting results that are worse. And unlike most other industrial countries, we still have large pockets of uninsured.
So why is that? What about our system makes it so inefficient?
A whole variety of reasons. But the biggest problem is The power in our system resides with the providers. Start with Big Pharma, the hospital systems. There's no incentive. When you think about how we pay providers, we pay them for services, fee for service. That incentivizes, this doesn't mean people are bad people, but that incentivizes greater and greater utilization. And so you have a combination of more utilization at higher unit prices, and that drives cost. And so you could argue how to fix it, and I have some thoughts on that, but the one thing I'm convinced of is that we are now basically have a provider-driven system at multiple levels. And then the insurance company's basic attitude is they take a profit on the overall rising costs. So if the costs rise, employers want to continue to pay for it, Medicare wants to pay for it, they get a percent. They get a percent on top of a larger nut. So I think for all of those reasons, the incentives are very misaligned in the system.
So if let's assume the politics, again, I'm going to give you a magic wand, and we can have a single-payer system, we can have a totally deregulated open marketplace, or a fix on what we have right now. What should it look like?
The biggest fix, I think you'd have to have a hybrid system. I don't think we're ready for a single-payer system, and I think there are legitimate concerns about a single-payer system. On the other hand, you couldn't convert to a national market. I mean, I would not upend Medicare right now. Medicare works quite well for what we're doing. What I think you do need to do is deal with the disparity between the employer market and the individual market in the following sense. You're right now, you run a place here, you provide health insurance to your people. You pay them with pre-tax dollars.
Yep.
By doing that, you disincentivize individual healthcare purchasing. If the same, Regina Hertzlinger up at Harvard wrote about this at Harvard Business School. If your employee, say you want to spend $15,000 for an employee with a family of four, if that employee could take that $15,000 and spend it in pre-tax dollars on health insurance, or if they want to spend $12,000 and keep $3,000 for income that would then become taxable, that would change the game dramatically. What it would do is it would move away from an employer-based system to an individual-based system. You don't need to be in the healthcare business as long as your employees get good products and good services.
Right. So kind of almost a voucher-based system.
Exactly, or a health savings account, however you want to design it. But what it would do is you'd then design individual policies and you'd have a consumer-based system. The reason Oscar, I think, is having the impact that it is we're a consumer-driven business. The major insurance companies today don't interface with their customer. Their customer is the HR or the benefits office of a large corporation. So they're selling into a different channel from the channel Oscar's selling into. So what Oscar offers, it's insured, is a very different engagement, helping you find a doctor. Everybody at Oscar has got a four-person concierge team when you're a member. So when you call up, you don't get put on hold. You're talking to people you know. One of those four is a nurse who knows you clinically. The other are care guides who can help you. We have a care routing system. We refer people, first-time doctors. They're looking for a dermatologist. We have free telemedicine. So it's a consumer-facing product. And my submission is until healthcare becomes a consumer-facing product, it is going to be a provider-driven product, and that's not going to work.
So when they created the ACA in 2009, did they not understand all this, or was their view that the only way to pass something was just to make kind of tinker at the edges of the
system? I think you got it exactly. I think I was involved a little bit in Hillary healthcare back in 94 in the White House. I think Hillary and Ira Magazine and others tried to design a system that they thought would have elements of cost containment and other things, and I think as a result the providers beat them politically. Then what happened is President Obama came along, and I think his view was, I got to get it passed. Once you get it passed, it will create a whole bunch of new people who will then protect it. It goes back to what I said about Machiavelli and status quos. Now we've had, with the Medicaid piece of Obamacare, you've got 23, 25 million additional people who are insured. And what you're seeing right now as the politics play out, those people have become a political force. We make it very hard to undo it. I mean, for the last 6 years now, more than that, 7 years, Republicans said it's time to get rid of Obamacare. They have a Republican president, a Republican House, and a Republican Senate, and so far they can't get rid of it. And that, I think, was the genius of President Obama's approach. However, we need, and this I think can only be done bipartisanly, we need to come together to bring some fixes to Obamacare and to deal with this employer individual disparity I mentioned before.
Can that happen politically, or do we just end up with these sort of radical attempts at repeal and replace that just don't pass because there's 25 million people who don't lose their health care and it's enough political force to prevent
it? One thing we would both agree on is you're the political genius in the room.
Yeah.
So you tell me if it, I keep wanting to believe it can happen. I mean, Washington has become so polarized and in so many ways so dysfunctional that you have to wonder. But there was a day when Washington could come together and solve problems. I mean, when Bill Clinton was president, we got massive welfare reform because he was willing to lead into it, not lean against it. Right. And I think that's what's going to take right now. We've got to bring people together. I have always believed that politics happens in the middle in America.
Right.
And the polarization is killing us.
There are very few people in Congress that I could point to today that would knowingly sacrifice their seat in order to get something done in healthcare or anything else, right? Like when Clinton did welfare reform, there were people, moderate Democrats, who sometimes lost their seats. There were Republicans who lost their seats. But you know what? They were willing to do it because they believed in public service. Everyone on the Democratic side right now is pretty cowed by the resistance. And so, you know, think about Schumer. I think he came into office, he knew Trump a little bit, felt like, hey, I can probably do some deals with these guys on some policy issues where we have commonality. And I think he meant well. And then MoveOn.org has a couple of protests outside of his apartment in Park Slope, and all of a sudden he's a no on everything. And he's the leader of the Senate Democrats. Pelosi is no different. And so if they're a no on everything because the only path they see is to be anti-Trump on everything, and the Republicans are split between conservative. I had a column on this actually this week, which is effectively we've got four wings of two parties, right? You got socialists, moderate Democrats, some moderate Republicans, and then libertarian slash, you know, socially conservative. And they're trying to shoehorn their views into a cohesive narrative for donors, for media, for the voters. And they can't, right? So as a result, they can't, as a party, put enough votes in to pass anything. And they really can't work together either. I don't know. What if we had three parties, right? Socialist, true ideology, libertarian, true ideology, and calm balancers, right? And they're effectively the people in the middle who can then impact either side, kind of call the shots. Because I don't see how what we have is going to get fixed or is going to work at all. I mean, what do you think?
What you say worries me a lot. I mean, I didn't feel that when I was in government. I mean, when I was in government in the 90s, I felt like I could work with people. I had a relationship with Orrin Hatch when we were doing judges that I felt was genuine, productive, and effective. Not that we agreed on everything, but that there is something called the national interest and the fact that there are people out there that we're supposed to serve beyond what you said, which is our next election. And I think that...
So what changed? I mean, how did you... So it's still only 20 years ago. How did we go from a culture where people were willing to work together and make some sacrifices, something now where they're just only willing to fight and protect their seats?
If I had a guess, and this is just a guess, I think a combination of the sort of impact of the technological revolution, the sense of globalization, and the feeling by a lot of Americans that the world is moving faster and in a way that makes them more and more concerned, not just about their future, but more importantly, their kids' future. When that happens, polarization develops, and that's what I think we're moving through right now. And plus, at a time, if the people in Congress, as you say, if they're worried about their reelection, they gerrymander their districts, they've got election protection, and so they're basically saying, I can keep my seat, that's most important. I dream my dreams, not dream my constituents' dreams. And so the incentives erode. Then you add to that social media, where now everybody davens at their own church. I mean, they talk to the people that they agree with, they get all wound up, and so this polarization perpetuates. I've said in many speeches, and it's two things that are really deeply on my mind right now. One is whether for the first time in my life, the things that unite us is Americans are less than the things that divide us as Americans. And I worry about that a lot. When I grew up, I didn't feel that. And the second thing I worry about equally is, are we in an era where the American dream becomes the American memory? Social mobility, all these things we talked about with education. I mean, if parents feel their kids' lives are not going to be better than theirs, working class families who work hard, I'm not talking about hedge fund guys, but working class families who's struggle to get their kids an education and have a better life than they had. If they feel that era is over, that's a pretty dismal
so
world.
Let's tackle that first one. If you have the polarization we just discussed and you just outlined because of the world is changing from a climate standpoint, an economic standpoint, a political standpoint, a technological standpoint so fast that people are effectively just trying to hang on to what they have, and that forces people into their corners, and there's no real end in sight for that, do we have to be one country? I mean, what if we said there's one group of people who really believe strongly, for example, in a woman's right to choose? They believe that climate change is real. They believe in open borders. They don't believe that people should have access to guns. And other people on the other side just as legitimately feel the opposite. If you truly believe that abortion is murder, it makes sense to oppose it with all of your might, right? Who's for killing babies if that's what you believe, right? If you believe that climate change is not real and that why would we sacrifice lots of people's jobs and livelihood over it, over trying to address it? You know, that's a thing worth fighting for. So let's say that you have two groups of people with really disparate views on really threshold issues. Why should we stay as one country? Why not have two or three countries and let people govern themselves and actually get things done?
It's very interesting, and to be candid, not something I've thought a lot about, because in the real world, it seems like something that's not likely to happen, at least during my days on Earth. I would say this, in some respects, though, the argument you're making is a federalist argument, which is why not have different states, why not allow for different, so if people right. want socially conservative place, go there. If they want to go to California, go to California. California's going to have its own, under Jerry Brown, its own climate policy.
Right.
They're going to try to create their own healthcare system and stuff like that. It would be, you know, you don't just jettison a couple of hundred years plus a history.
But nations are effectively artificial constructs, right? I mean, they're not written in stone. It's people getting together and making decisions and fighting wars, and nations
read,
are the outcomes.
If you read Sapiens, you'll realize all organizations
are
out of
that.
Because he makes the point. They're all constructs, but they're constructs that bring stability to an otherwise impossible world. So when you see in the Middle East, you don't have nation states. They live in chaos. And so the risk of destabilization at least has to be weighed into the process you're talking about.
Right, but we're not talking about nationless states. We're talking about two or three countries. The Soviet Union broke apart, and most of the former Soviet republics probably say they're better off for it.
Some of them do, half-half, and then you have the Ukraine, and you have the constant frictions about when they're going to return to where they were. So you're right. I mean, it's at least as a conceptual matter possible. I'd like to see how you knit together sort of New York and California going to be in one state with...
Yeah, there's a, you know, basically you have coasts and then you have sort of the center and the south to a certain extent.
And then where do you put, and then you put in the middle the Ohio's and the Pennsylvania?
Well, you know, but people would make choices, right? If you said these, Americans sort of vote with their feet all the time, right? So people made choices based on taxation, based on safety, based on climate, and, you know, they'd make choices based on gun policy or immigration or abortion, right? I don't really know why they couldn't do that.
So it's entirely possible. I think it's more likely that we'll see the teachers' union embrace accountability than we'll see two or three states.
Well, so let me throw another idea at you then. Mobile voting, right? So what I have found in my work is when someone has the opportunity to advocate politically and it's easy to do so because it's right in their pocket, they will do so. So I think of all the work that we've done with Uber, we've been able to mobilize people to fight against the taxi cartels, or we're doing that right now with FanDuel. We're able to get people to say, look, I want to play fantasy sports. I should be able to do so. And we make it pretty easy. You press a button once you're inside the app. We know who your state rep is, your state senator, your councilman, whoever it is, and we're able to get a message to them. People will advocate at very high levels, even for for-profit companies. When they have to go to a polling place, turnout plummets, right? You're looking at 12%, 14% in most primaries. If people could vote on their phones, would that not then get turnout back up to 60, 70, 80%, reflect the views of the whole and the center as opposed to the extremes on the left and the right, and allow us to get things done?
So the answer is, first of all, get a lot more people voting would be a great thing, no question. Whether mobile apps are sufficiently secure to allow this to be done in a responsible way, somebody smarter than I would have to answer. But if that would facilitate without a high risk of abuse, absolutely. Getting people more engaged, and this is why I think sort of the work Bloomberg is doing on the whole role of the mayor, more and more management is going to be taking place at the city level. And so I think getting people more engaged, making it feel more local for them, can only be helpful.
What do you think happens with healthcare? Does something pass? And based on your own work for Oscar, because you're in charge of all of the policy work over there, you know, what are your efforts? What's the best outcome for Oscar? Where do you think this all lands?
I think the question is, what's the best outcome for a country? And I do think sort of building on the strengths of Obamacare and fixing some of the problems of Obamacare is the best outcome. That, as I said, won't be done unless you get a bipartisan centrist coalition. I actually think if you counted the number of people in the House and Senate that would see the world through that lens if they weren't on the red team or the blue team, I think you could get it done. So the question is how we get to that. That's what I think the best solution is. Sitting here today, look, Yogi Berra always said predictions are always tough, especially about the future. All I can say is they're having a very hard time knitting together. And in that respect, I think it reflects the fact that Obama was just barely able to get it passed because it was a one-party bill. And now what you've got is the reaction to the one-party bill is to try and do another one-party bill. My own view has always been good things that get done in America get done when the parties come together and put the people ahead of the politics.
Yeah, that's getting harder and harder to do. I mean, even the ACA didn't pass any Republican votes. All right, a far more important topic now. Pizza.
Pizza.
You are, people don't know this about you, one of the foremost experts of pizza in New York City. So give me, and you're constantly going to new places and trying new things, top five places that you like right now.
Top five places. This is always perilous because I'd say Lucali in Brooklyn, Luzzo in Manhattan, the Roberta's in Brooklyn, in Manhattan, Motorino I like a lot. And Emily's.
Where's Emily's?
Emily's got three places. One in Clinton Hill, where she started. Okay. Then she opened a place called Emmy Squared, which is a really top-flight square pizza. And that one's in Williamsburg, and she just opened one down in the West Village. And what she has, in addition to great pizza, thin-crusted pizza, square pizza, but she's got one of the best hamburgers in the city of New York. So it's a real eat-a-thon.
So do you feel like there's sort of trends in pizza where things get kind of hot and cold for a while? Or do you think of sort of the traditional slice always wins out?
No, I think there, you do see some trends, like Emmy Squared. This is a different kind of thing, because when I got started in pizza and, you know, followed the pizza blogs and all the other things, thin-crusted Neapolitan pizza was all the rage. Then you saw, you know, sort of some growing out of DeFara in Brooklyn, which is a slice joint.
Yep.
You got somebody like Mark Iacono, who developed Lucali, which is kind of classic New York slice. And then you get sort of Roman pizza. You get the grandmother pizza. But if I had to say right now, thin crusted with a little bit of chew in the crust, San Marzano tomatoes and fresh mozzarella seems to do the trick almost all the time.
Do you know what a big green egg is? So it's this smokers, this giant ceramic device. I've got one at the house, and it can get up to about 800 degrees. And Lyle and I tomorrow are going to try to make a pizza on it, because apparently you can get it up to such a high heat that you can do it.
800 is the right number.
Yeah,
if you can get it up there. That's,
I mean,
great.
It's probably has to be on there for a while, but or we have to get the coals on there for a while. But I ordered some pizza dough. I'm not quite up to making that, but I'll make a sauce, get some cheese. We'll see how it goes.
Let me know how it works.
I've got an 8-year-old counting on me here. So, all right, Joel, thank you so much for doing this.
It's
a great podcast, and I know the listeners really enjoyed it.
Really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.